dynamic voices for a diverse church. This is Pass the Mic.
Hey folks, this is Jamar Tisby with another episode of Pass the Mic, one of our few episodes where we do an interview. Y'all know it's usually just Tyler and I gabbing away, but we're so eager to welcome our guest, Dr. Keisha Blaine. Welcome to Pass the Mic.
Thank you so much for having me.
Listen, I know you are basically the busiest historian in the field right now. So I just want to say thank you for making time for us on your book tour about this phenomenal new book, Until I Am Free, Fannie Lou Hamer's Enduring Message to America. Now, the great part about this, Dr. Blaine, is that regular PTM listeners are no strangers to Fannie Lou Hamer because she's one of my historical heroes. And we'll get into that in a moment. But before we do, for folks who may not be familiar with you or your work, tell us about yourself.
Yes. Well, there's so much to tell. I'm currently a professor of history at the University of Pittsburgh. I also serve as the president of the African American Intellectual History Society. And this is a scholarly group which focuses on research and the research and the writing of Black intellectual history. We focus primarily on the African American experience, but we're also interested in global Black thought. I think those who are familiar with the organization will know us through our blog called Black Perspectives. I was the founding editor, the first a senior editor of the blog Black Perspectives, and it's really over the last couple of years, it has been a wonderful space for us to talk about Black thought, Black history broadly. And in addition to that, I'm also a writer. I write for MSNBC. I focus primarily on race, gender, and politics, which of course are the core themes of my other research and writing. Before this book, I wrote several other books. The first solo authored book that I wrote is entitled Set the World on Fire. And it looks at Black nationalist women's political activism. Thank you. In the 20th century, that came out in 2018. And I've done several collaborative projects. The most recent one was with Ibram X. Kendi. And we collaborated on 400 Souls, of which you contributed to the volume. So thank you for that as well. And I'm just thrilled to be here to talk about my latest work, Until I'm Free, which looks at the life and ideas of Fannie Lou Hamer.
That's a wonderful synopsis. And I will say to our listeners and viewers, you're definitely going to want to follow Dr. Blaine's work. We have her social media handle on here, but also grab her other books. Really just an industry-leading historian in so many ways. And we'll talk specifically about your public engagement as we go forward. But I just want to say I'm such a fan of yours and your work, and also just the way you approach your work. So let's get into the book here. Until I Am Free, Fannie Lou Hamer's Enduring Message to America. So you're a historian. You counter all kinds of historical figures and actors. What was it about Hamer in particular that drew you to her?
Well, Hamer is someone who actually, I would argue, changed my life. And I was a senior in college, and I was taking a course on the civil rights movement. And it's in that course that I first learned about Fannie Lou Hamer. What's interesting is that I had already declared a major in history and Africana studies. So I was taking all these courses on the Black experience. And yet it took me quite a while to finally get to Hamer. I was deeply moved by Hamer's story. I was deeply moved by Hamer's words. Hamer's testimony at the Democratic National Convention in August 1964, which I think most people know. If they know anything about Hamer, they certainly heard that particular speech. To this day, it remains, I think, one of the most important speeches ever delivered at the DNC. And in fact, it was through Hamer's story that I came to find my own path. I was questioning myself as someone who as a first-generation college student, as someone who, you know, had a similar background, you know, working poor background, someone who really wondered, questioned what I could contribute to society, yep, given the limitations of, you know, in terms of access, in terms of financial resources. These are the kinds of questions that I asked. And what Hamer taught me was that I was asking the wrong questions. Instead of asking about what I didn't have, I needed to be thinking through what I did in fact have to offer. And for me, the answer was my writing and my research. I saw very clearly that I could contribute something to the world, that I could one day write books and articles that would shed light on the Black experience, and that would in fact center the voices of folks like Fannie Lou Hamer. So it's, I think, surreal, but really wonderful to be in this moment where I have this opportunity to tell her story. And I've been thinking a lot about her over the last couple of years, particularly because people have often asked me, how do you have hope? How do you, where do you find inspiration? You know, how do you manage to keep going when everything looks so, so bleak? And I think about Hamer. I think about all that she went through, all that she endured, how she pushed through. And, you know, as I'm sure we'll talk about today, it is very much connected to her faith.
Yeah.
And I think Hamer's story is one that every single person needs to hear. I think that this is an urgent book. It's a timely book. It's one that helps us strategize in this particular moment as we're dealing with the same concerns that Hamer grappled with, including voter suppression, including state-sanctioned violence. So I'm really honored that I have this opportunity to contribute in this way.
I'm just so interested in your backstory. Where did you grow up? What part of the country, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, I was born in the Caribbean, I think. But yes, I know, which is fascinating in and of itself, which is another story to tell.
Yeah.
One day I will write a memoir. But I grew up mostly in Brooklyn. I grew up in Brooklyn, New York. First, I was in Brownsville, and then mostly in Crown Heights.
Wow.
And yeah, and this is, I think, so important. In fact, there's a lot I could say because I think from a very young age, certainly understood the importance of, one might say, thinking transnationally. And so it's actually not coincidental that I've sort of gravitated to writing about Black internationalism broadly. Exactly. I was in a community of people from all over the place, you know, so just on my block. In Crown Heights, some of my neighbors were, you know, Hasidic Jews. Some of my neighbors were from Trinidad, were from Grenada, were from Barbados, from Jamaica. So it was this, you know, Afro-Caribbean community, interracial community. And I think all of these experiences really stayed with me. And when I went to Binghamton University, upstate New York, similarly, I was surrounded by people, a lot of people from Brooklyn, in fact, attended Binghamton. And I think one of the most inspirational aspects of my story is that I never even imagined myself as a historian, as an intellectual at all, until I had the opportunity to take a course with a professor, you know, by the name of Michael West, who was really the first Black professor that I encountered. He had a PhD from Harvard. And I remember marveling at that and thinking, wow, I had never encountered.
Black people can do that.
right. And that was so moving for me. But it's powerful because I think just knowing that, I started to dream about the possibilities and what the future could hold. And he was a mentor and still is a mentor, I have to say. To this very day, I still you know, reach out to him and rely on him for all kinds of advice. So I'm grateful for that. But in that moment, like, he saw my potential and he encouraged me and said to me, you can get a PhD. You can get a PhD. You're a good writer. You're a good researcher. He challenged me. He encouraged me to take his graduate courses. I mean, just really an amazing professor. And so many others too, similarly supported me at Binghamton. And nurtured me and made it, I think, just laid everything out for me. And even just applying to colleges, I, you know, for graduate school, I was very nervous, did not know what to expect.
Yeah.
And they supported me. So I'm absolutely, you know, without question, the embodiment, one might say, certainly the evidence of what's possible when you have educators who are supporting students, who are invested in the success of their students. I'm a testament to that. So I never imagined initially that I would become a professor, but once I set out on a path to become a historian, I just kept pushing all the way through, and I'm thrilled to be able to do this work.
Yeah, I'm so grateful that you pursued that. Grateful to Dr. West for encouraging you, and I'm so glad that you let us in a little bit to your backstory, because so much of the work that we do as historians is in some ways connected to our past and our journey. Let's talk about the journey of writing this book. So one of the things as an author that I'm always interested in is the evolution of book titles, because the working title that you have and the title that you start with isn't necessarily always the one that you end up with. Was there ever a different working title for this book? And how did you land on that final title, Until I Am Free?
Oh, this was the title I wanted from the very beginning. From the very beginning. Yeah. And I fought for that title because, you know, sometimes when you're going through the process, you have these conversations about, well, what's the best title in terms of marketing and all of that. But for me, this was the best title because the question that I asked myself was, what is a title that would convey the greatest and most, I think, most powerful message that Hamer wants to share with all of us? And there are so many things, you know, so many directions I could have gone in, because Hamer, and you know this, you know, she was just an amazing speaker, and she had all these like remarkable phrases. And, you know, she would say things like, you know, I'm going to tell it like it is. She will say, I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. You know, there are all of these iconic lines from Hamer. But this particular one stayed with me. This notion that whether you are white, whether you are black, you are not free until I'm free. Or put another way, nobody's free until everybody's free. Right. I think this was a message that Hamer constantly repeated and wanted people to understand, because it got individuals to shift their lens from just the individual to the collective.
Mm-hmm.
Quite frankly, we need that message today. And I wanted to make sure that the title reflected just the power of the message of unity, of collaboration, but more so a recognition that we are all connected, right? I mean, we may come from different backgrounds. There may be differences in terms of our socioeconomic status, our race, gender, sexuality, ability, like all of these things are important. But we have to live together. We have to be in this nation together. And that means that we have to come up with a way to make sure that all of us can not only exist, but thrive. And how do you do that? Well, first and foremost, you have to shift the perspective from I to the collective, right? To we, which takes us right back, right, to the notion of we the people, right? This is fundamental to democracy. And so this is a message that I think Hamer would want all of us to be reflecting on. And hopefully, if we embrace the message, then we could, I think, shift the way we operate, where we're no longer in conflict with each other, but we're listening to each other, and we're trying to figure out how to make things better for other people. It definitely calls for us to have empathy and concern for those around us, but it is truly a powerful message.
One of the things I'm curious about, and I'm eager to ask you as somebody who's sort of immersed herself in Hamer's life and work, what was different, do you think, about Fannie Lou Hamer? I mean, there were thousands of other Black sharecroppers, poor Black women, women of faith, all of these things, most of whom remain anonymous, a lot of times unjustly so, but you know, Hamer is what strikes me is that she's representative of so much, and yet she's also a singular figure.
Mm-hmm.
So in the course of learning more about her, like, what was unique about Hamer that made her become or opened the pathway to her becoming this, you know, activist we're talking about, you know, 40, 50 years later?
Wow, there's so many things. You know, as we've been speaking, one of the things that stood out to me in the process of doing the research was just the way that Hamer approached life. You know, I talk about in the book the fact that Hamer did not join the movement until she was 44 years of age. Mm. She got involved in the Student Nonviolence Coordinating Committee. This, as you know, is an interracial civil rights organization and a group that was grassroots, and it was student-led. So many of the people with whom she spoke and collaborated were much younger than her. Hamer never made that a problem. You know, I think about how even in today's context, we have all of these tensions between older activists and younger activists. And this is not to suggest that there isn't collaboration, but what can easily happen is that you'll have an older activist might speak disparagingly, you know, about what younger activists are doing and suggest, well, maybe this is not the best approach and you should listen to me, you should learn from me. There's a way in which these age differences and these, you know, these generational divides can in fact cause deep divisions within political movements, as they do within families and, you know, all kinds of contexts. What's interesting about Hamer is she just had a sense of humility. So she walked into the space and, she did not know a lot about what they were talking about. And so she opened up herself to learn. She listened. And once she acquired that information, then she wanted to share with other people. She never took this sort of approach that, listen, you're younger than me and you can't tell me what to do. You can't speak to me. No, she allowed Ella Baker to pour into her as she did Bob Moses. And that was, I think, such a powerful way to operate, because oftentimes I think we block ourselves because of our inability to listen, because of our ego, right? Because of our belief that perhaps, you know, we have more education or we have more experience. But what, you know, what happens when we can stop and say, the person speaking to me comes from a very different background. Maybe they don't have all of the things that I have, but they have something to teach me. And if I'm open, I can learn this powerful lesson from someone that can speak into my life and enrich my life and make me more effective in my work. And I think, you know, Hamer's approach was a unique one, but I think oftentimes we miss out on the opportunity to learn because our ego gets in the way or because we, you know, we think about perhaps our education and our experience and we don't acknowledge that there's still more we can learn. And I think Hamer's approach of always being open to listen, you know, to listen to others, to learn from others, made a huge difference. I would also say that here her faith is key. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that really strike me when it comes to Hamer's approach is that in that meeting in August 1962, when she's listening to SNCC activists, and she's, according to Hamer, it's the first time that she learns that she has the constitutional right to vote as a citizen of the United States. But what's interesting is that moment represents for her both a political awakening as well as a religious awakening. And what I mean by that is for Hamer, it's not simply that she's interested in voting rights, she's interested in being part of this movement to expand Black political rights. All of that is true. But more to the point is that there's a light bulb that sort of goes off for her where she realizes this is indeed her calling. This is divinely ordained. God mm-hmm. wanted her at that meeting. She mm-hmm. had not, you know, she did not have plans to be at the meeting initially, questioned whether she should go. A friend encouraged her to go. And she took this step and she recognized divine intervention. And she believed that it was God's will for her to live out her life, shining light into a world of darkness, speaking out about, you know, speaking out against racism and white supremacy, bringing truth and revelation to people. And that particular, I think, acknowledgement shaped the way she went about her activism. It meant that she didn't necessarily answer to people. She listened to people. She cared about people, loved people dearly. But even when people criticized her, even when they dismissed her, she stayed the course because she knew that she was answering to a higher power. I mean, this was not something to be taken lightly. And because she believed it was divinely ordained, she trusted that God would carry her through, that he would protect her, that he would guide her every step of the way. So that gave her this boldness. I was just talking to someone who worked with Hamer just this week. And this is Charles McLaren, you know, who was an activist in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And he was just recalling how when he took Hamer, you know, Hamer decided, you know, to run for office, ran several times. But the first time he was taking her to get registered and to begin the process of declaring, you know, that she was going to run for Congress. And he said he was so terrified for her because he had no clue what to do. And you know, at one point he says to her, you know, I don't really know what I'm doing here. You know, he's trying to help her. And she says, well, I don't know either, but but I'm here and I'm committed to doing this. Let's take care of business and let's not worry about the rest. And it was just something about this idea that a woman with a sixth grade education, with so many challenges, you know, who experienced such hunger and poverty in her own life, and had so many people dismiss her and critique her, would stand up and say, you know what, I can run for Congress. I may not win, but there's power in trying, and show up and do it anyways and fail and try again and try again. And I just, I marvel at that. And I think faith is key in understanding Hamer's passion.
I think her resilience and even her humility to learn from other people, I think faith is key in all of that. One of the things that I think about is, as we see throughout U.S. history and even in the present day, there are lots of different ways to be Christian. And mm-hmm. folks who call themselves Christian didn't always end up landing where she landed in terms of views on justice and race and poverty and class and all of those things. How did Hamer distinctly understand her faith in a way that led her to activism on behalf of the oppressed? Because we know there are mm-hmm. folks who are Christian nationalists. There are even other Black folks who are Christian who didn't get involved like she did or would have disagreed with some of her participation. So, you know, in your view, how was Hamer understanding her faith in a different way than under other Christians even?
Well, I think when I reflect on Hamer's faith and just the way that she lived out her faith, I think immediately about liberation theology and sort of this notion that she's able to read the Bible and first and foremost see herself in what she's reading. That is key, because I think oftentimes when we talk about an engagement with Christianity, and I would say too, I mean, this is true even in my own life. You know, there's a process by which you have to get to a place where you recognize that in fact, you are part of the story, that in fact, you are not alien to this message of liberation, but in fact, that you are also part of God's vision, right? I mean, and that he is committed to those who are marginalized, those who are being oppressed. One of the things that Hamer does, which I think is so powerful, is she's constantly drawing connections to Jesus. And she's constantly quoting from the book of Luke. And this particular passage that describes Jesus and his mission to set the captives free, to help those in need. I mean, this is what Hamer repeats in order to explain what she needs to do. She sees herself as following a similar path. For her, setting the captives free is a process by which she's bringing clarity and revelation to people so they can see particularly what is wrong with the United States. She's pointing out the hypocrisy of the United States. She's understanding that you cannot have any kind of expression of Christianity that doesn't pay attention to the here and now. And so she's resisting a lot of people who are saying, well, yes, things are difficult here and, you know, things are hard, but there's a better life coming, you know, in the afterlife, you know, there's a land of, you know, milk and honey, and speaking as if she has to wait until the afterlife, essentially, to experience, you know, true liberation and joy. And Hamer's attitude is no, we have to be attentive to the problems facing American society now. And in fact, true Christianity is being deeply committed to attending to the poor. How can you say you're a Christian and not care about those who are in need? How can you say you're a Christian and actually hold racist views? How can you say you're Christian? I mean, obviously, we know that this is happening because we understand, you know, the larger history. Folks, you know, groups like the Ku Klux Klan, you know, claim to be Christian too, right? But Hamer, I think, is approaching this in a way that we can see the connections, certainly, to an array of individuals, including other civil rights activists. But as we're talking, I'm also thinking about, you know, Reverend Barber and the Poor People's Campaign and Reverend, you know, Theo Harris and their work in the Poor People's Campaign and the way that they are recognizing that part of living out a life that expresses, you know, Christianity is in fact being deeply invested in supporting and helping, uplifting and you know, those who are marginalized and not simply adopting a kind of practice that deepens inequality and you know, that ultimately creates more of a problem as opposed to a solution in dismantling systems of oppression. So I see all of those threads when it comes to Hamer. And quite frankly, there's really no other way to understand Hamer's, you know, politics, you know, her worldview, without understanding how crucial faith was to all of it.
Hey, Jamar, you know, we have been doing Pass the Mic for about 7 years now. That is, I don't know how many episodes.
A lot.
Millions of downloads. I mean, so many sessions. And we still love doing this, right?
We absolutely do. I am amazed at how much energy we have. I think it gets better, like fine wine, over time as we do it.
That's what we tell ourselves.
Yes. Touch, man, and agree.
I want us to do this for another 7 years. And to do this, we are needing the audience's help.
Yes.
We need your help as listeners to fund this incredible work here that we're doing at Pass the Mic. And they can do that through our Patreon community.
Yes. Would you consider becoming a patron of Pass the Mic for just $1 an episode?
$1.
You can support this work. Go to patreon.com/passthemic, M-I-C, patreon.com/passthemic, and fund and fuel this work for the next 7 years.
The next 7 years, the next 10 years, who knows, the next 50 years, if the Lord should tarry. We are excited about
it. We're going to be holograms.
Yes, we will. But you can fund it at patreon.com/passthemic. Thank you all so much for your help and support.
Thank you.
I have so many questions around this topic, because that's what really has drawn me personally to Hamer, is the way that she understood her faith, the way that she practiced it in terms of, you know, until all of us are free kind of philosophy. She's up here on my wall in the middle. But to come back a little bit to your own story, and feel free to just say next question on this, but I gather from our conversations that you're a person of faith, and I was wondering if you'd be willing to tell us a little bit about your spiritual journey and how Hamer may have affected your faith or your understanding of what it means to live out your religion.
Absolutely. I think my faith journey is a complicated one, because initially I mentioned earlier just this notion of seeing yourself in the narrative, and that took me back to childhood. And you know, I grew up in the church. I didn't have a choice. I had to Baptist to go to tradition. Church. Absolutely. Yeah, well, okay. Yeah. So it, and that in and of itself went through a number of changes. So yeah, so I, at one point, yes, and then eventually, I was in a Pentecostal church. My family ended up sort of shifting to the Pentecostal faith, which was difficult for me because, you know, I would oftentimes sit there and listen to, you know, to the pastors, you know, expound the word of God. And this is not a blanket statement on, you know, in all of expressions of Pentecostalism, but just in the places where I attended, I just left feeling judgment all the time. I left feeling that there was 100 different things wrong with me, and the God that I was introduced to me was just, you know, this God of correction and rebuke, and he's always looking, you know, to point out something wrong. I mean, that was the message that I think came through for me, and I struggled with that. You know, I certainly had no choice. I kept going, and there was a moment where I finally began to see that this was not the full story, and that in fact there was another side to this, and this was a vision of God as a loving father, a vision of God that accepted me as an individual, that, you know, created me and loved me exactly how he made me, and I think that was empowering. One of the challenges that I faced, however, was in a period of my life, which I think you certainly understand, is finding myself as a Christian, you know, looking for places to express my faith, finding myself in predominantly white churches. Yeah. And then being completely dismayed, having interesting experiences and encounters where I'm passed over for certain opportunities, and I'm asking myself why, but I know the question why. I know the answer. So I'm asking the question, but I know the answer. Finding myself in spaces where people want my help, that, you know, they don't mind relying on me, you know, to do all kinds of things. I'm teaching, I'm leading worship, I'm doing all these things, but not actually even having the respect to reach out, you know, when I'm going through something or extend a hand of support. And so those are the moments where I started to say to myself, like, you know, what's the point of all of this? What's the point of being part of a community where I'm watching what's happening in the world? I'm watching and I'm feeling the pain of seeing what happens to Trayvon Martin, for example, and I'm going to my pastor to talk about it, and he's completely uncomfortable, and he doesn't really have anything to say. He doesn't really want to talk about it because now we've shifted. You know, he can talk about faith, and he can talk about, you know, how I could be a good Christian and my devotion and my walk, but he doesn't want to talk about racism. He doesn't want to talk about state-sanctioned violence, and it becomes clear to me that I can't continue in these spaces. I had to remove myself. I mean, quite frankly, physically remove myself from being in these physical spaces, and then having to accept that being a Christian is more than just going to church every Sunday, and that being a Christian is in fact a way of life. But to the point, it is similar to Hamer, you know, an expression of God's love toward other people, and knowing that you can't just be in this bubble, and that you cannot avoid topics such as race and racism. I mean, there's no way to do it. I'm grateful. And in fact, you know, we're talking, so I have to say I'm grateful for your work, because there was a moment where I recall securing several copies of your book and sending it to a few folks because I wanted to make a statement, you know, and I couldn't say it. So I'm like, you know, they'll read it and they'll get the message. And I have to say, to the credit of one of my former pastors who I was so frustrated with, he reached out to me over the last few months, in fact, and apologized and said how much he has changed in the process, how much he's learned from my own work, how much he's learned from your work. I mean, so that was great. I did not expect that. So, you know, to see someone who didn't want to talk about racism and didn't want to talk about state-sanctioned violence do this, you know, this complete shift and say, I get it. And I get that I cannot be a pastor and not care about these concerns. And that's powerful. But it's a testimony, too, right, to how much our writing matters. Because you just don't know who will pick it up. And you don't know how it's going to change someone's life. And so that is really, you know, it's been a journey for me. I'm still learning and growing. But I'm just grateful that in all of this, I didn't lose my faith in the sense that I'm still able to live out a life where I believe firmly that God is in control, that He has a plan. And I try to the best of my ability to live out my days in a way that would please Him. And I believe that part of that is using my gifts and talents and showing up, you know, even when I don't feel like it, but really showing up and doing the best that I could do, because He's the one who gave me these abilities. So that's you know, my story, which I think absolutely connects to Hamer's in many ways.
Very much so. And you know, thank you again for sharing that. I think that resonates with a lot of our viewers and listeners, certainly resonates with me. I mean, we had a whole campaign on our podcast called the Leave Loud campaign about these stories of Black Christians in these predominantly white Christian spaces, and how there was just this total, I wouldn't even call it a blind spot, because it was so willful in many ways. And the kind of damage that does or can do to one's faith, one's confidence in these spaces. So, again, thank you for sharing there. In talking about the book, you take a distinctive approach, and you're very forthright about connecting Hamer's life and activism to sort of what we can learn today. And I love the connections that you made, especially in one particular chapter. Talk to us about how Megan Thee Stallion connects to Fannie Lou Hamer.
Yes. And I have to say, it's so interesting, the process of writing, because I was working on this chapter on Hamer's ideas concerning feminist politics. And I was struggling to figure out how to best explain to a reader how we might understand Hamer as a key voice, and certainly, as I argue, a foremother of intersectionality, at the same time that she did not necessarily embrace the label feminist. And I remember like writing parts and pieces of that chapter and not quite knowing what would be the best like, contemporary example to send this message through, right, of how you can just step into a particular dialogue and shift the conversation in a powerful way without necessarily, even being viewed, right, as some sort of feminist icon. And here's where Megan Thee Stallion shows up, because, I think as many people know, she, was the victim of a violent assault. And she ended up writing an op-ed in the New York Times, not solely about her experience, and she certainly talks about her experience, but it's this op-ed of which she makes this powerful claim that we need to protect Black women. We need to care, actually, first. We need to care and protect Black women. And she talks about the unique challenges that Black women face in American society. Really drawing these connections, to the history. She talks about, societal perceptions and how Black women are blamed when they are victims of violence, as she was blamed. People, pointed out, her outfits, and they made all kinds of statements as if to suggest that, the violence that she endured was somehow justified. And she just laid everything bare, I think, it was so moving. Not once did she use the word feminist or feminism. And in fact, I don't even know if she's ever gone on record to call herself a feminist. But what she did in writing that op-ed, which was so explosive, people just consumed it and were moved by it. Mm-hmm. And I think once I read it, I thought, okay, exactly what she's doing here is what Hamer was doing in the 1970s, right? In 1971, when she shows up at the founding meeting of the National Women's Political Caucus, she stands up there and she's very clear that, you know, she's not a feminist. She's not embracing any term. And she's pointing out to these women who are in the women's liberation movement, and she's pointing out to them, pay attention to the unique plight of Black women. Pay attention to what Black women are going through. Look at the violence. Look at how we're being treated in your households too, right? Look at how all of these come together in terms of the systems of oppression, right? Goes right back to intersectionality. And I just saw the threads. When Megan Thee Stallion actually in her piece says that the way that she's conceptualized all of this is tied to a long history of Black women activists, I thought, aha, this is it. So I was, it was surprising for me. And I think, many people said, oh, I didn't expect that. But it's really just, what's so beautiful about the process of writing a book. You never quite know what'll happen how you can draw those connections, which is similar to the end of the book. I was trying to write the conclusion. I was struggling with the conclusion. I wanted to end on a somewhat high note. I mean, I didn't want to just end off with this very sad story of Hamer passing away. I mean, I had to tell the story, but I wanted to give a glimmer into of hope and think about the future. And then I'm watching, Kamala Harris talk and accept the nomination for vice president, and voila, she brings up Fannie Lou Hamer, right? And then I think, oh, that's interesting. And so I go back and listen, over and over again to the speech, and end up talking about it in the last chapter of the book. So in a similar way, Megan Thee Stallion's op-ed ends up showing up at a time where I was trying to best articulate how one can intervene in a conversation without necessarily having a label and that's the point. Hamer did not think of herself as a feminist, but she ends up shaping Black feminist politics to this very day. It's a really powerful story.
It truly is. And one of the things that I appreciate about you as a historian is that you make no bones about how and why your work should impact the present day landscape. Mm-hmm. And some would come along and critique that and say, scholars should strive to be objective, quote unquote. Yeah. So can you speak to that sort of argument and the idea of objectivity and scholarship in writing? Is there value in it, or do we in some ways need to rethink it?
Yes. Well, I believed this for a long time. I took all of these classes, as a grad student, and we spoke about the craft of history, and one is supposed to take a fairly neutral approach and not insert themselves, et cetera, et cetera. And then 2015 happened, which was another transformative moment for me. And what was that? It was the June of 2015, the tragic shooting in Charleston, South Carolina. And that was, in fact, another shift in my entire career. I was so devastated, as many people were, by the news of how this white supremacist walks into this Black church, sits, listens, participates in this Bible study, in this prayer service, and then gets up and just commits this heinous act, leaves 9 people dead. And that was bothersome enough. I mean, when I heard the news, I couldn't even do much that day. Mm-hmm. But what also added to my frustration was listening to the conversations that unfolded. And I'm watching all of these, talking heads on TV, and they're going on about, this is not who we are. And this is, this doesn't happen. And in fact, someone went so far to say, this might be the first time that this has happened in a Black church. And I'm sitting there thinking, wow. Does anyone read a history book? I'm guessing not. And I was so frustrated. And then was on social media and saw My colleague, Chad Williams, who's a professor at Brandeis, he was frustrated too. He was like, I'm so tired of folks going on and on as if this is an exceptional moment. It's not. This is unfortunately part of a pattern in U.S. history. And he said, he tweeted, you know, I think folks need a Charleston syllabus. And I immediately responded, I sent him a note and said, I agree. I really do think folks need a Charleston syllabus, and said, let's do it. And, you know, it's one of those moments where, so the two of us and Kedida Williams, who's another historian who's at Wayne State, came together and worked on this Charleston syllabus. We put together this list, this public list of readings on race, on racial violence, that would help people understand. It would help people contextualize this painful, this tragic event, and realize how it sheds light on the deep roots of white supremacy in this nation. And so participating in the Charleston syllabus was a moment, you know, where I recognized, listen, yes, I could write books and articles, and I could do all these things and take this somewhat distant approach, or I could actively be involved in producing scholarship that will help clarify, that would also be of use in my community. And also I had to accept that, you know, these are life and death concerns. I could not just, you know, I can't talk about police violence as some abstract thing. Yeah. And just, you know, I have to talk about it as someone who has witnessed it, as someone who knows the fear that came over me, and that several times I have never spoken about the moment where I, as a professor at the University of Iowa, was at the mall, and I had just made a purchase, and I realized that my lecture is starting in 5 minutes. I had wasted too much time in the mall, and I said, oh my, I need to get to the lecture. And I begin to run after paying for the product. It's in the bag, the receipt is there, and I'm running to my office. And it's only by the grace of God that I live to tell the story. A police officer was running after me because I looked suspicious. A Black woman running out of the mall. And he did not believe me when I said I was a professor. He wanted proof. I mean, we went all the way to my office. I opened the door. Whoa. So he would see. Didn't believe it, you know, just couldn't believe it. This Black woman with braids. No. And that was a moment, you know, and it's not the only time where I had those experiences. And so the point for me is that I don't have the option. You know, I just don't have the option to produce scholarship that simply takes this neutral approach. No, I need to be very clear where I stand. I need to be very clear about what I believe is right and what is wrong. And I need to make sure that I'm producing scholarship that will help my community, that will help Black communities, and that will open up the eyes of those who are willing to learn to be better. So I know that I'm critiqued for this. Let's be clear. I've been critiqued this, and I've been critiqued since 2015. In fact, some people said to me that I wouldn't get tenure because of my approach. I accepted the reality that I probably wouldn't, and decided that that would be okay. Kept going. By the grace of God, I did get tenure. And so I just think it's important to do the work that's meaningful to you, and to try as much as possible not to fall into the trap, you know, going with the flow, because, you know, Du Bois didn't go with the flow. No. Fannie Lamer didn't go with the flow. Right. And we're able to talk about them today because they stood up. And so, you know, these are my inspirations, and I absolutely want to make sure using my work to the fullest. And that means being intentional about why I write things and why I participate in different initiatives.
Ooh, whoa. Huh. Listen, you are quickly becoming an inspiration for many today, including myself. And the way you carry yourself, the way you stay centered, it's just very, like I said, inspirational. Last question. What does, you know, you're doing a lot of this intense work all the time, and you have this hectic schedule and this increasing profile, well-earned, well-deserved, a tenured professor, all of that. What does self-care and spiritual care look like for you?
Well, first and foremost, it's a life of prayer. I have to every day, I have to start there, because I cannot do this work on my own, you know. And like Fannie Lou Hamer, I recognize that I do have a calling, and that means just being tuned in all the time to what it is God wants me to do, or perhaps doesn't want me to do. And so only through prayer can I figure that out. It is really carving out in my schedule time to rest. And that's not easy, but I have to be intentional about saying, okay, I will not do events on certain times of the day and certain weekends, making sure that I prioritize time with my family, making sure that I'm being active and like not just sitting around, because, and it's hard with, especially with the pandemic, but just trying to care for myself. And the biggest lesson now that I've learned, you know, it took me a while, is not letting yes be the default, because I always, you know, I spent so many years just yes, yes, yes. You know, can you do this? Yes. Can you write this? Yes. And so now I've shifted where no becomes the default, and that forces me to pause and say, okay, if I'm going to say yes to this, why am I really saying yes? Right. And I think we have to take the approach, because quite frankly, people are just pulling at us all day long. You know, it's sort of the irony of being the token, right? In certain spaces, you know, you're there, you're the one person, everyone wants a piece of you. And, you know, but when you say hire more people who look like me, no, they just want to keep pulling at you. So the best way to do that, to protect oneself and to care for oneself, is to be able to lay out, you know, your expectations, make sure that you tell people, this is what I will do, this is what I won't do. And just, you know, as you said, being centered, it's not easy, but that's, you know, I'm also careful about who I surround myself with, because I've learned the hard way too, that, you know, if you're hanging around the folks you should not be hanging around with, you know, they, you know, people influence others. And if you really want to do your best work, you have to surround yourself with people who are equally grounded and who are also reminding you of what's important, and helping you at the moments where, you know, you are feeling down, or you might be in despair and you're struggling to figure out the next steps. It's good to be around people who could remind you of your calling when you forget it. So I hope that's helpful for someone.
Yes, yes. Well, I am so glad that you're making know your default and you're setting healthy boundaries, but I'm also elated that you said yes to this interview. Thank you so much for your time. Remember, check out this book, y'all, Until I Am Free. You will be grateful that you did. And we are so glad that you joined us. Dr. Keisha Blaine, thank you so much. And hopefully this will be the first of more conversations.
Thank you.